Okay, after a short break, we're back recording again. Okay, so we're back. The week Lehman failed, the reserve fund broke the buck, and we're discussing sort of the macro impact these events had, especially from the fund perspective. But zeroing in, and again, if this is your area that you're familiar with, on repo and the tri-party repo, how would these money funds have impacted those markets?
So one, I think there's probably a direct channel that I'm not as familiar with, Patrick, maybe, but I think the indirect channel is possibly equally important, which is when there's a liquidity crisis, anybody that has liquidity hoards liquidity. And so once you see that there's a run happening working through the money fund industry that is basically meaning that a bunch of short-term lending has disappeared, that anybody that has cash says, I need to keep that to myself. So what happens is these short-term markets are inherently fragile. That's been known since the beginning of time, that short-term funding markets have this fragility. And so that indirect channel is in itself enough to destabilize transactions and payment systems and affect economic activity very quickly. So there could be a direct channel that's working through the repo market and the money funds as participants in that market. But I think the point I would make is that just more generically, that liquidity crises, by their nature, invoke just rapid emergent episodes. That's sort of what they are, because they're working in the short-term markets. And so they have to, by their nature, they spread very quickly.
Because
they're happening in, the guy who needs to pay out $15 million today and was counting on a transaction that would have worked yesterday shows up today, and there's no one there to provide the $15 million, then they have to turn to their counterparty and say, that $15 million is not on the way. Then that person who was counting on the $15 million calls their counterparty and says, that $15 million is not forthcoming. And a system that's built on money cannot withstand that kind of thing. And that's sort of what was going on. So the indirect consequences, I think, in a true widespread sort of panic situation that's affecting short-term markets will automatically spread, and there'll be contagion rapidly throughout the system. So that's why it's a systemic event.
And
so it doesn't have to, at that point, it's no longer, you don't need to necessarily map out which particular
mechanism.
It's not relevant anymore, actually. It's become systemic and endemic, and it needs to be stopped.
And to make that point clear, so I think you could, with tri-party repo, just replace it, make Michael's analysis more specific. But at the time, we didn't, on Thursday, we didn't know how much tri-party repo the funds had unwound
right.
on Wednesday. What we did know was what was happening to commercial paper yields, and what was happening to asset prices, broadly speaking, right? So it was very clear that something horrible was going on. The tri-party market is just a market that is subject to the same kinds of incentives and run vulnerabilities that other short-term financing markets are subject to. So
right.
if the funds lose confidence in the counterparty, then they pull back. What counterparty would you have trusted at that point? Unfortunately, not many.
So sitting where you both sat, did you see that ranking of counterparties, was that something that you would have?
Not really. We could hear of it in meetings. So this is where people within the Federal Reserve System, in New York typically, where they're in the federal funds market. They talk to primary dealers at this point almost continuously through the day. We would get reports back from them, but it was all third hand.
But that was, and that was not the subject of what I what I was focusing on was more how people were ranking the fund managers,
right,
and what, you know, who was considered to be toxic, who was really in trouble Thursday afternoon, and that sort of thing, who was potentially at risk of not being able to meet redemptions Friday morning.
This is the Thursday after Lehman,
after
Reserve.
Right.
Okay. After Lehman. So out of curiosity, so who was at the top of the list and who was at the bottom?
Slim me opening my mouth. I could try to speculate. I could try to recall that. I'm just, I think I'd better, you know,
Okay. Well, I guess why was it that only during that week, before the Fed and Treasury programs came into effect, there was a whole week that you lived through,
right,
you know, this downward spiral, and yet there was no other fund that broke the buck. Now,
right,
some of them maybe received support, and maybe you could fill us in on which ones received support that week, but why wasn't there a whole domino cascading effect of funds breaking the buck during that 1 week after Lehman?
Oh, because, you know, I mean, there was substantial support for the funds. I think, you know, if had there not been a guarantee put in place on guaranteeing the AMLF put in place on Friday, who knows what might have happened.
Right.
I think the SEC has said that there were 100 funds that received, so that's a pretty substantial share of the industry that got support in September and October 2008. That's my recollection of what they say in their proposed rule release. And then characterizing, recalling, you know, so one group, I mean, I guess the problem is in naming fund groups, I'm just going to be naming things that just kind of come back to me. Like Dreyfus had a ton of Lehman paper. Didn't break the buck because they fully supported their funds. But it's hard for me to just go down the list. One of the problems also is the SIF-related fund bailouts merge in my head with the post-Lehman-related bailouts, and they're sort of related, too. Some of the same asset managers in both cases. There were some of the funds, as Michael pointed out, when you bail out a fund, there are a number of different ways to do it. You can actually lift the paper out of the fund. That is, the sponsor buys the paper out of the fund at amortized cost. The fund can also wrap the asset, or it can have more amorphous. So wrap the asset, provide a guarantee for a distressed asset, say, hey, we will bring it up to its amortized cost value. Another way to do it is some of the fund groups had agreements essentially to maintain the fund value at 99.5 or better.
Mm-hmm.
There were a bunch of ways to do this. Some of the things that had been done in 2007 to prop up the funds had not been fully, there were still support agreements in place, and they had to kind of add additional support post-Lehman. So
I do think, so to go back to something Patrick said, two things. One is that retail funds were fairly stable over the time period. So there's, you know, about at the time $800, $750 billion roughly of assets under management that are not being withdrawn. So that helps a little bit. The other thing is, though, that the next week that the backstops were in place, the Treasury guarantee and the AMLF, and that probably forestalled breaking the buck. It's entirely possible that it would have played out very differently the next week. So there was enough support put in place immediately that ended up only having to last a short period of time. There wasn't going to be the chance to keep supporting these funds over and over again indefinitely, don't you think? First of all, many funds, like Reserve, didn't have potential for any support. And even the bank-affiliated funds, again, capital is not abundant for those banks at that point in time. They could provide limited short-term support, but they were going to face very hard decisions over the coming couple of weeks. And my guess is those decisions would have gone the other way. They would have said, we're not supporting money funds. If you remember back earlier in the remember the ARS,
yeah,
the auction rate securities market, you saw a similar dynamic where there are 20 major firms that were marketing auction rate securities, and it was, they were all, for a period, it looks as if they're all hanging in there and supporting those auctions. And then once the first firm decides they're not going to support that auction, very quickly they stop supporting auctions. I think we would have seen a similar dynamic where, you know, Wachovia is going to support its funds. I think Wachovia, yeah, they were still in a bank then for a while. But once Wachovia stops supporting, then
the
Bank of America still going to support? And then is J.P. Morgan still going to support? The Nash equilibrium, so to speak, switches. Once you have reputation at stake, you want to hang in there as long as you can. But once your competitor has given up, then you may decide, again, that's not something you want to do. So, Mike, that's why putting these backstops in place as early as the 19th of September, you couldn't reject that was an important time.
Okay. Before we get to them, what were the securities that were in need of support that week? I mean, what was...
Well, Lehman, obviously. But my recollection was that if you looked at the list of securities that received support during that week, some of it was pretty clearly liquidity-related. I think some of the funds actually specified that. That is that it wasn't a specific security per se, but massive redemptions that they were worried about, and they wanted to shore this up to reassure their investors.
So it could have been commercial paper.
Oh, my goodness. I remember seeing one fund have this long list of securities that it was concerned about, and they included all kinds of non-financial companies that I hadn't even been aware were under strain.
Yeah, but it could be anything. The point
really
is, if you had... large certificates of deposit that weren't due for 32 days and you had a massive redemption, you may need to support an agreement that would support that. It was just purely because it didn't have to do with the underlying quality of the security necessarily, as much as the fact that it wasn't redeemable to cash the next day, which is really what you needed. So that's why I think at that point it was much more to do with a liquidity crisis than it was even, and that distinguishes it from the ABCP and the CIV crisis of the year earlier, is this is much more about the stresses that short-term funding markets were under, and therefore any security that couldn't be rolled and therefore could only be sold at deep discount. It didn't really have to do necessarily with that security being at question. It was just, you couldn't, like Patrick said, you couldn't just send it back to the dealer like you would typically would do. You had to sell it, and there's nobody out there with cash, so you got to sell it cheap. So I think it was much more, that's why we characterize this more as a generic type liquidity crisis than necessarily anything that would be triggered for sure by concern about the third firm in the list, AIG, Lehman, who's next. It wasn't really, I think, a who's next problem. It was, I have a legal obligation to redeem 85 million shares overnight, and I don't have $85 million here. So how am I going to make that?
Yeah, the fraction of the funds that actually held Lehman paper was on the order of 10-12%, from at least from my personal analysis. It gives you an idea. I mean, but the number of funds that actually got support was way larger than that.
Right.
And again, I think that during this episode, the primary concern was not individual securities per se, but the liquidity of the entire market.
So does it make sense for funds to be supported by a sponsor when on the prospectus of the fund it says there's no guarantee that anybody's going to support this thing? They try to maintain a dollar NAV, but it's not guaranteed.
When you say it doesn't make sense,
from
whose perspective?
From your perspective, does it make sense for these funds to be supported by their sponsors?
There could be, I guess... a question is, do you mean in terms of the incentives this sets up, or do you mean in terms of did it make sense at the time for these guys to do this? Or I guess
I would put it differently. So yeah. What I would say is that, you know, implicit recourse is where providing support at the sponsor's discretion to a fund is dangerous, and it's fragile business. And so I do think it's fair to say that a system that is reliant upon these implicit recourse or implicit agreements to step in at my discretion is fragile. And I think that's been a lesson that's showed up in many different aspects of the crisis. But this is certainly maybe the best case.
Well,
in which, because often what happens is that in normal times, implicit recourse is a helpful backstop. But in times of deep distress, you're not going to be able to count on the sponsors stepping in, because they probably already have resources or in short supply, and capital is scarce, and liquidity is nowhere to be found. And so the recourse is typically not available in all the times that it's needed. So that's what sort of makes it inherently.
Yeah, I think the
Clearly,
from the sponsor's perspective, it made sense. I think the systemic risk implications are pretty considerable here, right? So it's not just that. I think the auction rate securities market gives you an idea of what happens, what potentially can happen when you have a system of implicit support, and it doesn't work out. But let's also think there are broader implications. You attract, as investors get used to funds that maintain stable NAVs, even though in some cases the fund's own assets and shadow NAVs have fluctuated in value because sponsors have stepped in to support their funds, you have a industry that is perceived to be, in a sense, safer than it really is.
Yeah.
And so you attract more risk-intolerant investors, more money that is just completely intolerant of any NAV fluctuation. So there's an investor, the kind of type of money that you attract. And then, as Michael pointed out, once you get into a crisis, you have a problem whether or not the fund supports, whether or not the sponsor supports the fund. If the sponsor does support the fund, this is an entity that's off balance sheet. And suddenly, the debtors and equity holders for the financial institution that's providing the support get a surprise. I think people have pointed out that some of these support actions were detrimental to the stability of the financial institutions that provided them. If you don't support the fund, well, we have reserve to show us what potentially can happen.
Reserve did not have a strong a parent that could prop it up.
Right.
So, I guess you answered the question.
Yeah,
you know,
I answered the question. Part of the reason that, you know, the 2A7 rules are so evidently tight and the industry is so heavily regulated is because it's recognized that that there are fragilities, that if there weren't the 2A7, then, you know, you'd have this problem in spades, I think. So it sort of goes hand in hand. But I guess I would personally say that the 2A7 rules help in many circumstances. And implicit support can fill the gap in some circumstances, but that's not enough to give you confidence that the industry is stable, or it might trick you into thinking it's more stable.
Consider the analogy of a bank that has no nothing other than its own capital and promises you to convert your demand deposits to cash on demand.
So do you share other prominent ex-Fed chairman's views that these should be regulated like banks?
This is an extremely complex question, right? So I think that's its own discussion. The policy implications here are I think the discussion is needs to be predicated on what else is happening. Some of these things that we've discussed earlier, the enhanced cash funds, for example, are you going to do anything about regulating those? If your answer for what you're going to do to money market funds So I would posit that what you think ought to be done to change the regulatory approach to money market funds depends more broadly on how you handle some of their substitutes, including the enhanced cash funds, what you do with deposit insurance for banks, for example. All these things are interrelated. And so I think it's a little difficult to speak in isolation about what ought to be done and putting that in quotes to money market funds.
So I think I would personally say that it's worth spending a lot of time and attention studying how to improve the robustness of the short-term funding markets and interbank markets and the like. I think that the new 2A7 rules aren't themselves enough to give me confidence that all the rigor is in place, I guess.
Okay. I want to ask you one more sort of line of questions having to do with the PDCF, I guess the primary dealer credit facility, and then the contemporaneous treasury. What was that called?
I think you mean the AMLF.
You mean the AMLF?
Asset-backed commercial paper.
PDCF is different.
Yes, asset-backed. Thank you.
Yeah, the AMLF and the Treasury Guarantee.
Asset-backed commercial paper, money market, mutual fund, liquidity facility, AMLF.
Right, thank you.
Right. Yes.
And the Treasury Guarantee.
Treasury Guarantee Program for money market funds.
Were you involved in working with the AMLF at all in constructing that?
A little bit. Kind of as a consultant, almost.
Now, this is going to be...
And not me. I don't think I was in... I mean, I knew what was going on, but I was not involved.
This is slicing it really thin. Were discussions about something like an AMLF, did they precede Lehman?
No. Not to my... Wait.
Your involvement.
My involvement did not precede Lehman. I don't know when they began.
Okay. And you were brought in and first heard of it when?
I believe it was Thursday the 18th.
Whatever the date would be.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thursday after Lehman.
Yeah.
15th, 16th, 18th.
It looks like the 19th.
The Thursday the 18th. No, I know that if it was Thursday, it would have been the 18th.
Okay. But and so by then, it probably
you just
pretty much
a motion that was like, you're not totally sure what that would have.
This real-time stuff, I'm just, unfortunately, I'm not sure. I know when I was supposed to go on my honeymoon. and I know when Lehman broke the buck.
Right.
It would have been Wednesday or Thursday. It was after Lehman. It was obviously before Friday. So, yeah.
So what did you look at or discuss, and what did you contribute to it, if anything?
My only contributions were in helping them understand what money market funds were per se. So like the how would you define the funds that would be eligible to use the AMLF. Right, so that was a consideration, and so there was some concern about wording this so that it was specifically targeted at the 2A7 funds. But the exact language for that needed to be worked out. Some discussion about how broad it should be. Should there be other investors and that sort of thing?
Did they ask you if this were adopted, what the impact was likely to be?
Honestly, I don't recall. I remember when I first found out what was going on, I turned to Bill English and said, thank you.
So I think that means that Patrick had a sense that this would be valuable.
Had you made recommendations that week? Someone's got to do something. Is there some program we can adopt? Is there something we can do?
I had a variety of phone conversations with people about what kind of that to the effect that something had to be done, but not, you know, did I actually sit down and say, here's a recommendation for something? No, I didn't do that.
Okay. And the Treasury guarantee, did you talk with folks at Treasury or anywhere?
No,
like
I
that?
Did not. No, no, no.
Not me.
No.
So not. You just read about it in the paper when it was...
No, because in the AMLF discussion, it was not made clear, but there were... there was mention of Treasury rolling something out, and I'm not sure that at the time that I was involved in the discussions, anybody really knew exactly what it was going to be. I just wasn't really clear, I think, at the time on what it might be, other than that they were potentially going to be rolling something out.
So those were launched that weekend?
No, Friday. They were announced on Friday, September 19th.
Okay.
They went into effect, as I recall, the AMLF went into effect, I want to say the following Monday, but I'm not entirely sure. And the guarantee, the assets. Well, you could work with the
assets. It was the assets as of September 18th.
Right. Yeah.
I remember that.
And you could just see that on the releases. I'm sorry. They would tell you specifically
what the details were.
Yeah.
So on that Friday.
Friday morning before markets
so
opened.
So did it have an impact on the markets?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you're asking researchers, right? But I mean, in terms of the data, it was fairly clear. So. In the days leading up, so let's just think back on what the asset flows were from money funds, the outflows from prime money funds. So on Tuesday, about $102 billion came out. These are some industry numbers that we've corrected for some problems with these are iMoneyNet numbers that we have corrected for some problems that they have. But about $102 billion out of funds on Wednesday, about $92 billion on Thursday, about $34 billion on Friday, I think about $12 billion on Monday. Keep in mind, as Michael and I described, the economics of this are that flows should start to outflows should actually accelerate. And instead we saw, and then over the course of that week, I'd say on the order of $50 billion that following week, but up against, you know, essentially $100 billion outflows on a couple of days the previous week. And I think there was it wasn't just the numbers. The pressures that, discussions of what was going on from market participants were also making it clear that this had been affected. Keep in mind, I am in France at this point, so... the numbers that I've just recited to you, we would have had them with a day's lag, although they would have been a little erroneous. They looked like bigger outflows, I think, on Wednesday than the numbers I cited. But I think it was overwhelmingly clear to my colleagues that certainly ex post that this had been very effective.
A couple questions.
If you think of this book as going to the regular reader, you know, the uninitiated, and it's coming out in December, what would be the best summation of where the financial system is now, thinking of it as December? Is it recovered, healed, healing?
Part, I'd say. I mean, this is my opinion,
yeah.
So this is Palumbo speculating, providing, opinion. I think there are aspects of the financial system that seem to be functioning more or less normally. We don't, read in the paper anecdotally about particular pressures. The data don't show spreads and yields and flows look more or less normal. So we're talking about like the interbank funding markets where we look at LIBOR rates. And Treasury yields are low, but they're not negative right now for Treasury bills, for instance. We see that commercial paper is neither contracting nor expanding. It's just sort of moving sideways. It's up $4 billion this week, and it's down $3 billion next week. And we can look at the ABCP spreads, and we can see them that they're bouncing around. They're 8 basis points today, and they're 6 basis points tomorrow. So many of the things that we look at in sort of along many aspects of the financial system, I think, are more or less functioning normally. The macroeconomic environment is still far from normal, and that has financial market both counterparts and consequences. So it's, you know, the unemployment rate is not normal. The levels of investment and household spending is not normal. And those have consequences. Bank lending is not normal, though neither is it contracting at the double-digit rates that we had seen even as recently as this spring. So things are a little bit normalizing. And in some markets, they truly do look fairly normal. On the other hand, they're not, they're nothing like what we were observing in 2006 and even into the first half of 2007, where the volumes of activity were outsized by historical comparison, where the innovations or the evolution of transaction types was still occurring at a pretty rapid clip. Those were things that seemed abnormal and proved unsustainable. We don't really see most of the markets that were where there was the most activity taking place. Those are just not functioning. Those are still basically in dormant state. And so that's the sense in which I don't think all of those activities will be dormant perpetually. Some of them will be, I presume, for quite a while. But that's the case where there's still not normalcy, I think. So right. I think it's still fair to say that the overall supply of credit isn't that normal. The overall level of demand is also not that normal. And so, but you don't see the dysfunction in many places that we were seeing even up through the early part of this year, I would say. I mean, some markets normalize more quickly than others. The ones where the Fed and the Treasury directly intervened, those seem to sort of cure the fastest, or where the ECB stepped in. But so I'd say in terms of functioning, many things are normal. But in terms of the overall volumes of activity, some are more recovered than others.
You talked about, you used the word.
Can I just add one thing, a caveat in addition to being one person's educated view of one person's view, is this is as of September 28th, 2020.
Right.
Or a report that's going to be in December, which is sort of the equivalent of
we
were talking in July.
I'm asking for the kind of guidance that helps us make sure that we write with the
right
frame in mind.
Right.
It's guidance, really.
Right.
You know, you're
I think writing
guidance so that we're not overly exuberant.
But neither would I say we're in the crisis phase today at 3:20. I would say, in fact, and I would go maybe personally one step further, where is there's at least some scope for resilience now. So the next shock, I also don't think would necessarily be devastating the way it could be, but. It could be.
What's so the next shock going to be?
I don't know.
I think there's another angle on this, which is, so Michael's characterizing the overall financial situation. I think, you know, we would want to interject here that we see money funds as continuing to be vulnerable.
Yes.
And that is a major concern. That is a major strategic vulnerability, structural vulnerability to the financial system. And that's, just as it was 2 years ago. And I think that's this is staff-level thinking, but we're worried about this. And I don't think it's not that we think that there's going to be a problem tomorrow or in December, but we just see this as a vulnerability. And
So I agree with that, and that's what I meant to say, that the new 2K7 rules that the SEC put in place, for example, to us, that just maybe strengthen, it maybe protects a little bit more, but it does not address the underlying vulnerabilities. We would say that more is needed, but as Patrick said, you've got to think about the whole system. So I think there is still a lot of scope for improving the resilience of the financial system, and I think that's the hard work. You said earlier, are we looking back or looking forward? We're looking forward. We're trying to understand, in implementing the new statutory authorities and responsibilities, and then considering, you know, where there still are regulatory and supervisory gaps, how do we build a system that really is resilient to a broader range of shocks and innovations? And I think that's a process that will take quite a while. So I don't want to say that tomorrow we could withstand the next major shock, especially when the underlying macroeconomy is still fundamentally weak. I mean, I think that is a major problem.
Can I follow on that? As a non-expert in any way in this room, we've talked about the financial crisis, and the mandate of the FCIC is to think about the financial crisis and an economic crisis.
Right.
And you talked about one feeding into the other, into the macroeconomic. To what extent can the macroeconomic situation have a feedback loop into the financial system?
It can. So it does it through a few ways.
Critical.
The main, a major way is through the performance of credits, so that, you know, the more people you employ, the more current they stay on their obligations, the more income flows through the financial system to the lenders, and then you do tend to get, I would expect, frankly, a favorable feedback to work in that direction. So I think there is plenty of scope for there to be a positive feedback loop that works. I think it's not just through the credit quality channel, but that is one way that it would work through.
As long as we're steadily recovering, but slowly, the feedback loop could build in a positive way, is what you're saying.
It can build in a positive way.
And do we see that? Do you see that?
No. I mean, the economy is, I guess, a little bit. I don't know. I guess I don't have a sense. So if the feedback is working, it's not working powerfully. In other words, it's not so transparent that we all agree that it's evident in the data. We do see that there's a gradual improvement in economic activity. We do see that measures of credit quality and corporate profitability and household incomes are rising. Credit quality is improving, delinquency rates are falling. But I guess I would say that the improvements are sufficiently gradual and moderate that I wouldn't argue that a feedback is forcefully in play at this moment, as at the end of September. I would expect, if it was truly something where you were really getting mutual reinforcement, and what we think of as really a cycle of mutually reinforcing and beneficial outcomes, it would feel more powerful than today. So I do think that it can happen, but I wouldn't say it's, and I don't think many would say that it's in force at this moment.
The other question I want to ask is, we've had some people tell us in interviews, economists say that it could take 6 or 7 years for us to recover in some sense in terms of what we've lost, and there's lots of ways you can measure that. Should the tone of the report be, obviously we can't look in the future,
right.
We don't know, blah, 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 but would you say, considering the pounding we took, that that's a reasonable way to convey the level of injury?
Yeah, again, let's talk. We should talk a little bit about what metrics you would use. Because there are, there's a lot of confusion about what metrics people are using. And then there are different camps. I mean, you have the new normal camp, or these are the guys who are fundamentally pessimistic on not just levels of activity in the medium term, but growth rates of potential output and standard of living and productivity in definite future. And then you have people that are much more optimistic about not just the long-term growth prospects of the country, but the actual rate at which things will normalize. Or they won't new normalize, they'll old normalize. So there's just a lot of...
speculation.
Yeah, and different... You know, and it's not idle speculation. It's thoughtful, but just disagreement about that. So that's one thing I would say. I do think it's fair to say that the contraction has been deeper and longer lasting than we've experienced, I think, in the post-war period, you know, really since the Great Depression.
Sure.
And so that does suggest to me that absent a forceful virtuous cycle that were to kick in like soon, that I would expect that it will take, that it's reasonable to think that it will take years to recover fully in terms of like the unemployment rate moving right back to its long run or its natural rate, the output gap, you know, the shortfall in actual GDP to potential GDP sort of moving back in line over time. That's going to take a while absent a feedback, which could very much happen. So
I think
the base length forecast is for, I think the consensus forecast. I mean, that's where you just talk to people and add up what their average forecasts are. But I don't think it's an unreasonable thing to think that it will take a while. I guess there, I would just characterize in August, certainly in June, the Monetary Policy Report includes the FOMC's forecast. There's a discussion in there about the long-term outlook, and that might be the place I would tell you to look through.
Well, I want to draw you out. Years. Years is more than one. That's two.
Yeah.
A while is whatever. Okay. So...
I don't know. I don't feel like I can really speak.
I'm just asking you for the tonal. So,
in yeah.
other words, years not... instant, on the horizon, we don't know. Just,
yeah. If I was writing it,
yeah.
I wouldn't be promising anything.
Okay.
And I wouldn't, I guess I would just say, I guess I would try not to, I don't think there's a big payoff to predicting what January of 2013 is going to be if I was writing the report.
Okay. Good.
I'd resist that. That'd be the type of thing where they're going to look back in February of 2013 and they're going to say, oh, the FCIC said that by now things would be looking rosy. And either they will be or they won't be, but it just seems like the upside is not good. But so right now the recovery is very gradual. GDP seems to be growing at the 2% rate. The unemployment rate is basically maybe moving sideways at 9.75%. There are people forecasting reasonably rapid improvements, but it's all forecast. It's all
sure.
based on what the December data, the January data will look like. It's not based on even an extrapolation of July's data, and that's what would make me unwilling to.
And what does consumer spending look like now?
It's growing at 2 to 2.25% in that range. So it's not like a recovery, it's like
back to school,
you know. Yeah.
Can I just one follow up? You said you still have concerns about money fund vulnerabilities. So again, in terms of writing a report for the average person who may have, you know, their, you know, the recommendation is to have what, 3 to 6 months money sort of available in liquid cash.
Wait.
Don't worry. Just get the question.
Well, let's back up because you're going to be writing about. I mean,
I'm trying to. Okay, yeah, I'm just trying to put it in the context of the average person reading a report, and that average person may have some investment in money market funds. In your opinion, should the average person worry that they may lose money in a money market fund?
I mean, I'm not a financial advisor. I'm not. I just
so I don't want to go there.
But this isn't giving advice to a person which fund to invest in.
It's not about the causes of the financial crisis and the 24 things that you had to address. This isn't on that list, right? So
Can I just say something? I think our concerns about systemic vulnerabilities don't necessarily map into, you know, what, you know, so the instruments that we think are at issue don't necessarily, we might think banks are at risk, we may not. Does that matter for an individual investor? I don't know. That depends a lot on what kinds of protections are in place and so forth. I think what I described to you, the SEC chairman actually in her speech when they put out the new money fund rules in January of this year mentioned that, look, the new rules aren't enough.
Right.
And why not? Well, because the incentives that Michael was describing, once you have seen, you know, once you perceive that there's some risk that a fund is going to lose value, you still have an incentive to get out, and that dynamic can get going again. And what the new rules do is make it less likely that you'll ever get to that perception. The problem is that they don't eliminate it. And I think, and that's one simple way to put it. You can go and look at what Mary Shapiro says specifically, but there are, you know, still contagion risks in the funds and so forth. How that maps into investors' choices about different asset classes, I just think I really need to suggest to you that I'm not sure that what we've discussed today is relevant to that. Remember, and this is not, again, this is not really relevant to any investor's choice, but remember all this stuff we've been discussing with money market funds. There was one fund that broke the buck during this period. So you have to be a little bit, and that fund lost, you know, at the end of the day, I think it lost, once investors get their, you know, their money back with some horrible liquidity shock, right? Investors still, I don't think, have all their money from reserve. But I believe they lost a cent on the dollar. So, you know, that's a very different discussion than the discussion about the systemic risk of the funds.
Right.
You know, in other words, if you were to write this, you were to drop down from Mars and say, you know, let's look at what happened to the fund industry. Let's see, they had $2.18 trillion, prime funds had $2.18 trillion in assets in this period, and gee, now they have only $1.6 trillion. Good grief, that's terrible. Well, that would be terrible analysis, because what actually happened is the fund assets were, they came down, they went up, and now they've come way down because people don't want to hold the funds because they're not paying high yields.
Yeah.
Moreover, you could make a mistake and say, gee, this industry, look, there's a $2 trillion in assets, and how much capital loss was there in that? Well, 1% of $62 billion is not even $1 billion,
right,
out of $2 trillion. And yet, the events that we're talking about are extremely important, right, systemically. So I would.
Does that make sense? That's actually really important, okay? Because it's what Patrick said is absolutely right. It's not relevant for me. I still have money in my money market fund. It's not relevant for that part of my life. It is relevant for the part who reports to the board on the stability of the financial system, and those two things aren't the same. And actually, they're. Have nothing almost to do with each other. That's a bit of an irony. And this gets back also to what's normal. How are things normal? So what I meant to say is that in many aspects, functioning in a wide range of markets are more or less normal. The things that's abnormal and that's fundamentally maybe as least normal as we've seen since the Great Depression, is that we're building a new financial system. And that's going to be happening over the next several years. That's going to be a process that plays out over a very long period of time. And almost certainly, right, with fits and starts, that's like about as unnormal as anything in my lifetime. So I don't know how to characterize that. It's great that, you know, that Key Bank can fund its obligations overnight. That's great. That was not true probably in November of 2008. But it's bizarre that I couldn't tell you sort of some of the basics of the rules of the game that will govern trillions of dollars of transactions 4 years from now. So I'd say at that level, it couldn't be less normal. So that's why we're trying to be a little nuanced here. And I think Patrick's point is a really good one, that the things that we'll be working on, if we're successful, couldn't be less relevant for the median American. The whole point is to devise a system that is robust to a wide range of behaviors and unexpected events. And that's what we have to try to do. And if you're successful, no one will know about it.
All right. Well,
good place to end.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Let's go on.
All right. Thank you.